The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week, when it comes to the science in cinema, it's not just about what's on the screen. Increasingly, it's about how we look at what's on the screen.
I got an email from DreamWorks Animation. They'd
read. Did you think it wasn't real when you got it?
I did. I questioned it. They were very eager for me to come over and actually present my research.
I'll be talking to researcher Tim Smith about the use of eye tracking software in working out what makes an eye-popping film. And
when you're listening to beats, that's the separation of the discrete frequencies. That is the tempo of the song, essentially. That's where the sort of tempo comes from.
Who said science is not cool? This week we meet someone who's a physicist and a DJ. Martin Archer's taking budding young scientists and showing how wave-particle duality of electrons can be explained using the music of Beyoncé. Also, The Guardian's Ian Sample and Nell Bowes join me in the studio to discuss this week's science news, including Germany's deadly encounter with a new strain of E. coli, a missed opportunity to find alien life, and worms from hell. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian.
Is it water?
It's salty. You drill a well, it's hard not to get salt water. The oil is there. I'm telling you. I want to go now, so...
Well, you can stay tonight.
No, I want to go now. I want to leave.
Listen, Paul. If I travel all the way up there and I find that you've been lying to me, I'm going to find you and I'm going to take more than my money back. Is that all right with you?
Yes, sir.
All right, then.
That was the brilliant Daniel Day-Lewis in a scene from Paul Thomas Anderson's film There Will Be Blood. But for this next segment, it's a case of There Will Be Science. This scene has been the focus of some intriguing research into how we view cinema. Psychologist Tim Smith used eye-tracking software on 11 people who watched this chosen scene, and in a fascinating piece of video on his blog, he traces the gaze of the viewers, mapping both the position and the time. To tell us what we can learn from all this, Tim's joined me in the studio. Welcome to the show, Tim. And before we start, why don't you just take me through what it is that directors do to shift our gaze during a film?
Well, most films these days... will use very kind of obvious strategies. Like if they want us to look at a certain object in a scene, then they'll cut to a close-up. So they'll have a camera which will go in and film a closer shot of someone's hands interacting with something on a table. Or if it's a longer shot where there's lots going on, they'll control the focus in the scene. So they'll make certain things in the background out of focus, focus on, say, one person's face so that we're more likely to actually have our eyes drawn to it. They can do the same thing with lighting in a scene, put like a spotlight or a large kind of contrast in lighting so that our eyes are drawn to a particular part, and also the action itself that's happening on the scene.
And when it's done well, we don't notice this stuff. It's just our eyes tend to move to those bits that they want us to see.
Yeah, we'll have our eyes kind of involuntarily drawn to it, so we'll just seek out the bits where the content is. So we'll look at someone's face because it's what's in focus, it's what's well lit.
In your research, what is it you, when you started the research, what was it you were trying to answer?
What I realized is looking at film, there's a lot of techniques for manipulating our attention and changing the way we view a scene. And looking at it from the kind of the real world perspective, we didn't understand to a great deal how these how attention could be manipulated. So by looking at film, we were learning about the kind of techniques, and then we can actually investigate it by recording where people actually attend when they're looking at films.
So the scene we just heard was from There Will Be Blood. Describe to us, just in plain terms, what was actually happening in that scene?
It's a pivotal scene in the film. It happens very early on, and it's where a boy comes to the Plainview character to tell him that there may be some oil in their land, and he wants to sell him the location of it so that they can go and actually start digging. And it's a power play between the boy and Daniel Plainview about how much money they can get for the situation and the information that he's willing to give. But what's novel about it is that there's no editing in it. It's all done in one long take. The camera's in position and all the action happens in front of the camera across a tabletop. Most films these days would have chopped that scene into like 10 or 20 different shots. And this isn't. It's just about the people acting in front of the camera.
And so you decided to get some volunteers to watch the scene, but fitted with eye tracking equipment, which is in itself fascinating. But let's not talk about that right now. But so you could tell where they were looking throughout the scene.
Yeah, every millisecond we can see exactly where in the scene their attention and their eyes are focused, and we can see how rapidly it shifts around. So from that we can see what are they attending to, what are they actually able to see, and what are they not able to see, as in the bits that their eyes never go to.
So what did you find?
Well, although there's not a lot of kind of composition in the scene, it's just people acting in front of a tabletop, you get a surprising amount of consistency in where multiple people will look at every moment during the sequence. So they'll attend to people's faces when they're talking, they'll attend to their hands when they interact with objects on the table, and they'll shift their attention between the people as the conversation shifts between them.
And is this, I mean, you could argue that, you know, people like to look at faces, people like to look at hands pointing or things moving, anything. If a scene's static, then whatever moves is what you look at. And it's a kind of evolutionary thing, I suppose. But is there any indication or sense that this is what the director wanted you to do and has specifically meant you to do that? Normally they would cut to the hand pointing at a piece of paper if that's what you see. But in this case, it's kind of risky for them, isn't it? Because you might not be looking at that.
It's very risky. And there are moments during the sequence where the viewers will look in different places.
So they're confused.
They're confused, or maybe at that moment they're not being directed as tightly. If I look at people's eye movements when they're looking at a spontaneous conversation that two non-actors have, then there'll be moments where we still all look in the same place, but there'll be a lot more moments where we look in different places. What's interesting about this There Will Be Blood sequence is that it's staged and the action is choreographed so precisely that there's very little overlapping action or dialogue. So it's very clear who is the focus of attention at a particular moment. And that's due to a very close relationship between the director and the actors to make sure it's staged in such a precise way that the viewers always know what is relevant right now.
So the director is not only directing the actors on screen, he's directing the audience as well. It's kind of a weird sort of reaching out from the screen thing going on.
And it's always been that way, even going back to theatre productions in vaudeville. It's been about how can we shape the viewer's experience in the way that we want to as a director.
And what's it telling us about how we construct our gaze? One thing that I think most listeners of this podcast will probably know, because we repeat it so many times, is that most of the sensory information that comes into our eyes and ears and everything, our brain essentially doesn't allow us to process, or at least consciously process. Mm. The world around us is essentially an illusion created by the brain, because it would just be too difficult to process everything. And what does it tell you about that sort of weird illusion that our brain creates?
Well, eye tracking, because it's so high speed, basically we can record what is coming into your retina every millisecond. So if we take a kind of illusionary experience like that, we can say at which particular moment did their experience diverge from actually what's in the scene. So one other aspect of my research is looking at magic tricks and how magicians will actually kind of manipulate your awareness of a scene. And we can see in their eye movements whether a person will pick up on the trick, or whether they'll be completely fooled by it because of where they look and how they seek out the information over time.
Magic and illusions are something that I know psychologists are using a lot more of nowadays to try and understand how we attend to things. I mean, I didn't know it was also important in film. How are they related?
They've been related as long as cinema has existed. A lot of the early filmmakers, for instance, Georges Méliès, were actual magicians first and foremost. They knew how to manipulate a person's experience of a scene using the kind of attentional tricks that that I'm recording in There Will Be Blood. It's picking up on what people think are relevant, looking at faces, looking at hands, expecting certain things to happen. And so a magician is using it to maybe sculpt your experience in a one-to-one setting. And a film director is using the same techniques to focus your attention to a point in a scene so that he can then direct you to it.
I'm assuming this. That your intent is not to deconstruct it to such an extent where people don't enjoy films anymore. What is it you're trying? What is it you think filmmakers can learn from this sort of stuff?
I think that by applying these kind of methods, so recording devices like an eye tracker and other kind of psychological recording methods, you can start quantifying someone's experience online. So whereas a film for us is a beautiful kind of rolling experience, emotional, cognitive, and then afterwards we can reflect on it. These techniques give us a way of saying, okay, what's happening at this particular moment? How is that being constructed? And that's interesting from the psychology side to see how dynamic our experience of the world or media is. But from the film production side, that is their job. Their job is knowing how are you experiencing a film in a moment. Are you enjoying a scene that you're supposed to be enjoying? Are you laughing at the right time? Are you attending to the detail you're supposed to be attending to? And up until this point, they've been using their own introspection and experience to be able to guess at whether it's working in a scene. But they've had no way of actually testing that online. So by combining these methods, they can actually really question someone's experience of a film.
When I was asking you before about how people might use this, when you wrote about your research recently on a blog, you had some interest from filmmakers, in fact.
Quite fascinating. I got an email from DreamWorks Animation. They'd
read. Did you think it wasn't real when you got it?
I did. I questioned it. They were very eager for me to come over and actually present my research. And it confirmed what I'd thought for a long time, is that there's a lot of these questions in the actual industry. They're dealing with these questions on a daily basis. But they maybe don't have the tools to actually answer some of the questions. So they wanted me to come over, present my techniques, present how it could actually integrate with the filmmaking process and inform the decisions they're making on a daily basis.
And so what kinds of things were they interested in mostly?
They're very interested in how to actually how to structure a scene so that you get clear kind of fluid shift of attention from one shot to another. How do you create this phenomenon known as continuity, which is an ease of understanding what's depicted on the screen? There's a lot of techniques and a lot of insight for how to do this in traditional 2D film. But of course, DreamWorks Animation, a lot of all the other big production studios right now, are trying to do the same thing in 3D. And it's a big open question about how does this change your experience and what's the right way to do it.
I mean, you would think that there's nothing hugely different. I mean, what is the, why would there be differences in 3D compared to normal 2D?
It introduces some awkward technical differences. Like a lot of the early recent 3D films would result in a lot of eye strain, where it was difficult to actually watch the film for a long period of time. And a lot of that is because the way the film is presented, you have to wear the polarized glasses, which means it's darker, so it's harder for us to actually see. But also when they're presenting depth, if the depth is not balanced right on the image, so it's not clear how the depth happens, our eyes often can't resolve that depth. And so they're bouncing around trying to figure out, where am I supposed to be looking on the screen? And that can strain our eyes over time. So what the filmmakers, such as DreamWorks, are starting to realize is that you have to have a precise insight into where you want them to look, what you're putting on the screen, and what the eyes are doing in response to that, in order to make it a pleasant, continuous viewing experience.
Is it likely you're going to get a credit on the next multi-billion-dollar?
We'll see.
do you get like a percentage? I'd go for the percentage fees. Don't go for a one-off fee.
I'm not sure I can discuss these.
Seriously. Seriously, do what George Lucas did. Keep the image rights. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks, Alan.
Big thanks to Tim Smith there. To read more and to see examples of his research into how we look at the big screen, check out his blog, continuityboy.blogspot.com. Now it's that time of the show when we take a look at the top science stories from the week. And of course, I'm joined by The Guardian's Ian Sample and Nell Bowes. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So without question, the biggest story this week involved a deadly bacterium and some Gurke.
Wir haben feststellen können, dass es sich tatsächlich um eine neue, bisher noch nicht beschriebene Variante dieses Erregers handelt. Und wir werden zukünftig hieraus verschiedene Rückschlüsse.
That was the German bacteriologist Holger Rode revealing that the deadly form of E. coli found in Germany this week is a pathogen that we've not encountered before. E. coli is a bacterium found in many animals, livestock, as well as humans. And mostly it sits there harmlessly. Whenever it does cause problems in humans, it tends to cause diarrhea for about a week. And then if left untreated and people drink fluids and things, it'll go away by itself. But this form of E. coli found in Germany has been sequenced by the World Health Organization. And they found that it's actually something very different. It's one of the class of E. coli called the virocytotoxin-producing E. coli, which is unusually virulent. And it's been found on tomatoes, cucumbers, leafy salads, and the German health authorities are advising people not to eat those things. It's interesting because 18 people have died so far, and it's causing something called hemolytic uremic syndrome, which is a very rare severe kidney complication that destroys blood cells and can cause problems with the central nervous system. It's just, this is why it's highly unusual and why people are so concerned about it. Russia has banned all imports from the EU, even though there's been no cases of this disease in Russia. And in Britain, so far, there have been about 7 infections, and 3 of them are of this hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS, which is quite dangerous. So it's all hands to deck, really, on keeping track of this stuff.
So, Alec, what's the best way to treat it?
So in Germany, where HUS is sort of appearing more readily than it has in the UK, what they're doing is transfusions of blood plasma. So they've been sort of replacing the blood plasma of these people. And I mean, it's a dangerous thing. It's serious, but around 98% of people do recover eventually from this particular condition. What's weird about this particular set of cases, though, is that normally it just affects children and there's a bias towards females, but actually in this case it's sort of affecting lots of adults as well. So there's obviously something about this E. coli which is more dangerous than people know, and the gene sequencing will have to continue to try and find out what it is.
Is it likely to turn up in Britain?
Well, so far it hasn't, and at the time of recording at the end of last week, it hadn't turned up in Britain. The problem is that no one really knows where the source of this bacterium is, where it came from. I mean, it spreads. If it's spread on vegetables, it means that some contaminated water or soil has been sort of near these vegetables, but no one knows where it's come from. And so until they pinpoint that, it's going to be hard to actually work out when it sort of how it spreads. The Food Standards Agency in the UK is working on data from the European Commission, and so far they've not seen anything that has come into the UK that's worrying, but you know, it could just be a matter of time. Let's move on from that to the original superbug. Ian, there was a paper published in The Lancet last week about MRSA, a new strain. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so this was some work by led by Cambridge, and it was in a journal called Lancet Infectious Diseases. It was the identification of a new strain of MRSA. Two things that were interesting about it. It was discovered on British farms. It's the first time MRSA has been found in any British farm animal. Probably more importantly, the same strain has been found in people, not in huge numbers by any means, but it's been identified and confirmed as the cause of a small number of really serious blood infections caused by MRSA, and also some of the usual sort of skin infections you get.
I mean, without being alarmist about it, is it something to worry about?
So these scientists have already identified that this new strain can cause problems, but MRSA can. I mean, that's what the issue with MRSA is. It can get into exposed wounds that aren't sterilized and so on. It can cause sometimes mild, sometimes very serious and even lethal infections. Now, there's no reason to suspect it's any more virulent than normal MRSA. In fact, some really early tests suggest that it's actually a bit less dangerous, but it is still a problem nonetheless. One of the interesting things about it is that there is a gold standard test that relies on genetic techniques to confirm whether an MRSA is in fact that multi-resistant form. And those gold standard tests will not detect this. They will say, no, it's not. They will test negative for it. And that's because it's sufficiently genetically different to normal MRSA that it doesn't show up. Now, that's a problem in some places, certainly on the continent. In the UK, it's not so bad because the way we test for MRSA is we essentially get a sample off someone, off the infection. You grow it in a petri dish next to antibiotics. And if the bug continues to grow into the drug, you know it's resistant, so it doesn't actually matter what the genetics of the thing are. But what's probably the consequence of this is that farm workers are now going to have to consider themselves as likely to pick up MRSA as nurses and doctors, and they need to be sort of have that on their mind in terms of when they're, you know, their cleanliness and stuff like that, particularly the dairy farmers.
Let's rattle on to a story from a completely different planet. Nell, tell us about one of Saturn's moons.
Well, this is a story about Enceladus. The Enceladus focus group met recently and to talk about possible missions to the moon to have a look for life. Because it turns out that Enceladus is possibly even better source for life than Mars in terms of having kind of the requisite water, carbon, nitrogen and energy that we might look for to support extraterrestrial life. The reason partly why this is coming up in the news is that we're running a bit short of time to get a mission together in time to use Jupiter to assist any probe that we'd send out there. One way to get to Enceladus would be to get a gravity boost from Jupiter, and the next best window for that would be in 2015 for a couple of years.
So you'd have to design and build and launch a spaceship that would get to Jupiter by
2015. And yeah, if you don't do it by then you don't get another chance until at least the 2030s. So it's sort of... Some people are saying now or never. Others naturally are just saying, well, actually a Jupiter assist would only win you kind of 3 years on the total journey time. So it's better to hang on, really get together a good mission that can test for all the kinds of biomarkers that you'd be looking for, look for amino acids, look for different balances in the carbon-12 and carbon-13, and just take a little extra time to do it properly.
Ian, go on.
If you flew over like Earth in billions of years' time, you know, hopefully you would still see, or millions of years' time maybe anyway, you still see some kind of footprint that we were here.
Concrete
we
tower blocks, did that kind of thing.
Yeah,
roads.
Exactly.
But, they're not looking for sentient life, are they? They're looking for...
I know, but that just means we're on a mission for disappointment, because the first alien we find is going to be so spectacularly disappointing and dead that we're just going to go, yeah, we're not alone, but we kind of might as well be.
All we've got is a small semi-bacterium.
Someone's replaced Ian with Marvin the Paranoid Android. It's like brain the size of a planet, there's nothing there.
It's hardly a kind of Copernican knocking down off the pedestal of humanity.
Well, it kind of is, actually. Even if there's
we're
just bacteria somewhere.
We're not alone in the solar system. We've got this and then
but we can't talk to it.
Bugs.
Hey, you know, you might complain about bacteria, but I mean, there's more bacteria than humans on this planet. So
can I bring up my good bug story?
Yes, I was going to say, let's move on
to
another bug story. This is a bacterium-filled story there. News jam, isn't it?
It's about subterranean worms that have been discovered.
They're
deep.
Not just any old subterranean worms.
They're hell-based subterranean worms.
Well, there you go.
Halicophalibus mephisto, after Mephistopheles, the... evil demon. They were discovered deep in mines in South Africa.
What are they doing down there?
Well, they're eating what is described as big layers of snot, which is the...
is that in the paper?
It is. Biofilms of bacteria that exist deep in these incredibly deep mines in South Africa. They've actually discovered a species in the Tautona mine, which is more than 3.5 kilometres down, and temperatures are around 48 degrees C.
So hang on, these killer worms, well, they're not killer, they're snot-eating worms from hell.
Yes.
How do we know they're from hell? Is there a genetic test?
Well, actually, they haven't done the...
A red gene, maybe. it looks a bit pointy with a little tail.
To be honest, the research teams say that the worms are much more likely to evolve near the Earth's surface and move down.
Rather than hell.
Okay. But it makes a good headline. I think we should go with it.
Well, and on that note, thanks to Nell Bowes and Ian Sample there. And remember, for the best science news site on the web, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And now, the Hannaford question.
I am Paul Nurse, and I'm president of the Royal Society, the UK's National Academy of Science. And the question I'm most interested in is actually more a question for physics. I've been reading things which seem to suggest that the origin of the universe, of everything within it, could be explained that it could actually come from nothing. And what we have is sort of fluctuations of sort of plusness and minusness. And if you put them together, there's nothing there. But we're all simply deviations from nothing, and that produces something. I think this is really quite interesting, and I'd like to see how that will develop over the coming years.
Talking of things emerging from the vacuum, next week sees the launch of the Cheltenham Science Festival. It's a jamboree of some great science, and if you go along, you'll be able to see this man.
Hi, I'm Martin Archer from KISS, and I'm going to tell you how you can Ouija, that's DJing using one of these things, the Nintendo Wiimote controller. Now, it is the controller for the console, but it can be so much more, and I use it as a DJ tool in clubs.
Well, when DJ Martin Archer is not hacking a Wii control to mix music or taking to the air on KISS FM here in the UK, he's a hard-working physics PhD student. I'm delighted to say that Martin's joined me in the studio to tell me more. Welcome to the show, Martin. Now, clearly from that intro, you're very cool as a DJ, but we need to establish your science chops. Anyone on this programme has to know their quantum physics and their synthetic biology. So why don't you just take us through what your PhD is all about first?
So my PhD is in space plasma physics, which also sounds pretty cool.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's actually looking at the solar wind and its interaction with the Earth's magnetosphere. To see how the structures that are inherent in the solar wind as it hits the Earth, how they propagate through, how they change, all that sort of stuff. So kind of space weather is a word that gets banded around quite a lot, and that is sort of within that field as well.
Space weather has been in the news a lot recently because of the fact that we're all worried about our satellites being smashed to pieces by them. And just tell us why space weather is important.
Well, space weather is important because the sun has these massive storms. We get CMEs and solar flares all the time. And, you know, increasingly now we have all these satellites and we're hugely dependent on them. And we've just come out of a solar minimum. So the sun's activity is starting to ramp up again in its 11-year cycle. So anything that can affect life on Earth, our sort of technology or anything like that, power grids, we need to be wary of now, because even more so now than, you know, the last time we were heading towards a solar maximum, we are even more dependent on this technology.
And just tell us what it is that's coming out of the sun that's going to affect these things. Well, the solar wind, what's it made of?
The solar wind is a plasma, so it's really hot gas of mostly hydrogen, and it's got all these magnetic fields embedded within it. It's traveling really fast, supersonic. It hits the Earth, you get this massive shockwave created around it, but things can get through that. It's not a completely impenetrable shield, our magnetic field.
On your website, you talk about how the stuff that you do, you know, as a DJ, when you go to schools or when you talk to sort of children about this sort of stuff, that there's all sorts of stuff in DJing which is very scientific, sort of beat matching, waves, all these things. Take us through a bit of that. Well, what is it you think is the commonality between the subjects?
Well, the thing is physics, if at its core concept, is just about all these base principles, just finding, you know, commonalities in themes and you know, things like energy and frequency. You know, they go across all areas of physics, and that's why, you know, if you do an undergraduate degree in physics or even if you do an A-level, you come across them all the time. And I thought, well, you can find them everywhere, and in DJing there's a huge amount of physics going on there, and I'm sure I can tease it out and sort of link that across to people, because a lot of people, you know, you listen to music and you don't think of physics, you just sort of enjoy it at face value, as it were. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on there, so I wanted to tease that out and get that across to kids, and also sort of show them what the cutting edge stuff is, you know, the really more abstract physics, the stuff that's a bit harder to understand, how you can link that through to get people engaged, really.
So go on, tell us some of what you've been telling them recently.
What have I been telling them recently? I've been telling them how, just by listening to, like, Beyonce's beats compared to David Guetta's beats, you can understand how electrons form up these sort of standing waves if you just surround them with a ring of atoms.
Go on. I want to know how. It sounds intriguing.
The sort of idea is you have to have this understanding of a frequency space, like a different space to the one that we live in, but where everything is contained at very discrete frequencies. And when you're listening to beats, that's the separation of the discrete frequencies. That is the tempo of the song, essentially. That's where the sort of tempo comes from. So you get that idea, and in a standing wave, I don't know if you've, the one I do for the DJ Physics show is actually a Rubens tube, which is a standing wave in flames, so you can see sound getting turned into fire, which is always kind of cool. But so you can give this idea that you can only set things up only certain frequencies can exist. And by showing that in the beats, you can also show that in the flames. And I then have some cool pictures of electrons doing exactly the same thing on the quantum scale.
Do you think David Guetta and Beyonce were aware that they were into physics this much?
I don't think that they were aware that they're actually masters of quantum physics.
What else? You're going to be playing at the Cheltenham Festival next week. What kinds of stuff are you going to be doing in that show?
So it's an hour-long show teaching you how to DJ, but from a physics perspective. So how physics can help you to learn to DJ.
Do physicists make better DJs? Let's just say yes anyway, and then we can tell me the truth.
I think they probably do. I think they've probably got more of an idea of why something sounds good. You when you learn to DJ, you've got to learn what sounds good and what sounds rubbish, and you sort of hone that out. And if you're a physicist, I think you can probably understand it a bit better. And so that's what I try and get across.
When you say sound good, there's huge amounts of qualitative measurements going on there. Do you mean literally beat matching and
well there's lots of stuff. So there's the beat matching. You can tell if, you know, frequencies are drifting, they're not lying on top of one another. In terms of sort of volume jumps, if you're going from one song into the other, getting the EQ right, so you're getting the right sort of mix of frequencies and psychoacoustics and stuff like that. I think from a physics perspective, you've got a better idea of what's going on rather than trial and error.
So when is it you're playing?
So I'll be doing DJ Physics at Cheltenham Science Festival on Saturday the 11th of June, 4:30.
Tickets still available, hopefully?
Yes, yeah, just go on the Cheltenham website for that.
All right, Martin, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks to DJ and scientist Martin Archer there. And if you want more information on the Cheltenham Science Festival, just go to the website cheltenhamfestivals.com. That's all we have for this episode of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.